From TNN headquarters, this is The Jungle Cast.
Hello, welcome to The Jungle Cast for August 14th, 2015. Now today, let's take a look at the past. Actually, quite a bit in the past. In 1988, several people ran for president. 1988 was the year that George H.W. Bush won his term as the presidency. But on the Democratic side, there were more than two candidates, but two of those candidates were Al Gore and Joe Biden. Now, both of those people were senators, and both would eventually become vice presidents. However, neither of them actually ended up attaining that office of the presidency. However, recent reports indicate that both of them are taking a renewed look and possibly making another run at the presidency in 2016. Now, as we've brought up on TKNN before, Vice President Biden is currently looking at running for president in 2016. He's taking a new look at it. His family has been trying to encourage him to do so. And now that he's on vacation in South Carolina, which is the third third event with the nomination, they have the primary, and it follows the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. Then there's South Carolina, where he actually polls very well. But side note, that's all side note. He is on vacation there, and he's taking that time on vacation in order to kind of decide on a presidential run and start to put out some feels and feelers. There are reports that indicate that he's been talking to public officials and party officials about a possible run. So we'll have to see what comes of that. And obviously, it seems like if you look at those reports, he is starting to take steps towards a presidential run. Now, Joe Biden was not the only one that I mentioned with 1988. In 1988, like we said, Al Gore, then a senator from Tennessee, ran for president. Later on, he became vice president to a man known as Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton became president, ran in 1992, served until 2001. Now, in 2000, Al Gore ran for president again. And he lost the Electoral College and the presidency. He won the popular vote, and this time he won the nomination, unlike Joe Biden, or unlike Al Gore in 1988. He won the nomination this time, but he didn't win the presidency. In a pretty controversial election, which is probably an understatement, since it was arguably decided by the Supreme Court, he lost the election because of the Electoral College. Came down to Florida, lost the election to George W. Bush, who served 8 years. Now, with Bill Clinton, his wife, who was then First Lady during that administration, First Lady Hillary Clinton, is now running for president. And she's doing fairly well, or very well, when it comes to the Democratic nomination. Poll out of Iowa shows her still over 50%. In New Hampshire, recent poll actually has her down 6 points, but she's still doing very well when it comes to the primaries. Well, and the caucuses. However, the general election, which is part of the reason why she's doing so on the primaries, because people think she'd be strong in the general election, there are some warning signs. Polls continue to show her not doing very well in battleground states. You can find specific polls on our website, tknn.info. Plug that in there. But another problem that she has is that people don't find her trustworthy. Other polls, in addition to not finding her trustworthy, she's not seen as caring about people's issues. So it seems that when it comes to the general election, she's weaker than anticipated. So where does Al Gore play into this? Well, as the Democrats start to fear that their frontrunner may not do so well in a general election setting, the 2000 nominee is starting to take another look at it. Now, we should say this comes from BuzzFeed's Andrew Kaczynski. And he put out a report yesterday, or a report from BuzzFeed, says that former Vice President Al Gore is pondering a 2016 run. And this comes as polls show Hillary Clinton not doing as well as people thought she would do. And it also comes as, like we said, Vice President Biden taking the the run. Now, Kaczynski's source, Democratic source, tells him, A, quote, they're figuring out if there's a path financially and politically, end quote. The source later on continued by saying, quote, it feels more real than it has in the past months, end quote. Well, of course, Al Gore has been seen as a potential candidate, whereas, like, he was in 2004 and 2008 and 2016, well, in 2008 and 2004. It's largely because he's relatively young when it comes to politics, and there's also a tendency in politics that if you are a nominee and you don't win, it's not uncommon and not unheard of to run again. So people say Al Gore may run. He ends up not running, but they always say he might. And now this report says that they're starting to take a possible look at it. Now, a Gore advisor did tell Kaczynski that the advisor asked to be quoted as saying, quote, or excuse me, let me reword that, because I just want to make sure we can get the verb in there correctly. The Gore advisor did ask to be quoted as saying that they were, quote, pouring lukewarm water, end quote, on the rumors. Now, Kaczynski, and you probably, good old listener, did note that we use the word lukewarm rather than cold water. Kaczynski kind of implied that that was almost proof that they weren't completely ruling it out, but there's a little bit of nuance there with the use of lukewarm rather than cold water. Now, following that BuzzFeed report, ABC's Rick Klein said, and confirmed with a source, that there have been discussions about a possible Gore run. Although, we should point out with Kaczynski that he did report Vice President Gore has not spoken to his political advisors about a run. But Rick Klein goes out and he confirms with another advisor that there are discussions about a possible Gore run. And like we said, in 2000, Gore won the nomination, the popular vote, lost the general election, lost the Electoral College and the presidency. And since then, Gore is really focused on his climate advocacy and his television channel, Current TV, until it got sold to Al Jazeera. And since it's been sold, he's kind of had some time on his hands. However, what we should point out with Gore, there are some people who are pouring cold water on Kaczynski's report. The Tennessean's Dave Buescher reported that sources were telling him that there was no exploration of a presidential run by the former vice president. A spokesperson for Gore said the reports were not accurate. A friend of Gore's told Buescher, quote, I've heard nothing along these lines, and I'd be very surprised, end quote. CNN also reported that there were, from Jeff Zeleny, that there are no discussions about a possible run. So some reports saying that Al Gore is taking initial steps to possibly ponder a presidential run, others saying not really. Now today, Friday the day we record this, is being seen as a pretty historic day when it comes to American diplomacy, and especially America's role in kind of Latin America and American-Cuban relations. Today was the opening of the American embassy in Cuba. After the kind of relations with Cuba were normalized, we were able to reopen our embassy because our embassy was closed 54 years ago. However, we waited before, like, the Cuban embassy has been open for a while now. But we waited to open ours until John Kerry, the Secretary of State, could get there. And today, Friday, he did arrive for the raising of the flag. I should point out that the formal opening of the embassy today, it has been operating since then. But today, the formal opening and the raising of the flag, and in a nice tribute, what happened was 54 years ago when we closed the embassy, the U.S. closed the embassy, three Marines were in charge of bringing down the flag. They said to themselves that they would eventually return to put up the flag. 54 years later, they were on hand to deliver the flag to three Marines that raised the flag back up. Now today, as part of the ceremony, Secretary of State John Kerry did have a little bit of speech. So we're going to take a listen to that.
It Please be seated, everybody. Thank you very, very much. Muchas gracias. Buenos dias. I'm so sorry that we are a little bit late today, but what a beautiful ride in and how wonderful to be here. And I thank you for leaving my future transportation out here in back of me. I love it. Distinguished members of the Cuban delegation, Josefina, thank you for your leadership and for all your work of your delegation. Excellencies from the Diplomatic Corps, my colleagues from Washington, past and present, Ambassador De Laurentiis, and all of the embassy staff, and friends watching around the world. Thank you for joining us at this truly historic moment as we prepare to raise the United States flag here at our embassy in Havana, symbolizing the reestablishment of diplomatic relations after 54 years. This is also the first time that a United States Secretary of State has been to Cuba since 1945. This morning, I feel very much at home here, and I'm grateful to those who have come to share in this ceremony, who are standing around outside of our facilities. And I feel at home here because this is truly a memorable occasion, a day for pushing aside old barriers and exploring new possibilities. And it is in that spirit that I say on behalf of my country, Los Estados Unidos acogen con beneplácito este nuevo comienzo de su relación con el pueblo, el gobierno de Cuba. Sabemos que el camino hacia unas relaciones plenamente normales es largo, pero es precisamente por ello que tenemos que empezar en este mismo instante. No hay nada que temer, ya que serán muchos los beneficios de los que gozaremos cuando permitamos a nuestros ciudadanos conocerse mejor, visitarse con más frecuencia, realizar negocios de forma habitual, intercambiar ideas y aprender los unos de los otros. My friends, we are gathered here today because our leaders, President Obama and President Castro, made a courageous decision to stop being the prisoners of history and to focus on the opportunities of today and tomorrow. This doesn't mean that we should or will forget the past. How could we, after all? At least for my generation, the images are indelible. In 1959, Fidel Castro came to the United States and was greeted by enthusiastic crowds. Returning the next year for the UN General Assembly, he was embraced by then Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. In 1961, the Bay of Pigs tragedy unfolded, with President Kennedy accepting responsibility. And in October 1962, the missile crisis arose, 13 days that pushed us to the very threshold of nuclear war. I was a student then, and I can still remember the taut faces of our leaders, the grim map showing the movement of opposing ships, the approaching deadline, and that peculiar word, quarantine. We were unsettled and uncertain about the future, because we didn't know when closing our eyes at night what we would find when we woke up. In that frozen environment, diplomatic ties between Washington and this capital city were strained, then stretched thin, then severed. In late 1960, the U.S. ambassador left Havana. Early the following January, Cuba demanded a big cut in the size of our diplomatic mission, and President Eisenhower then decided he had no choice but to shut the embassy down. Most of the U.S. staff departed quickly, but a few stayed behind to hand the keys over to our Swiss colleagues, who would serve diligently and honorably as our protecting power for more than 50 years. I just met with the foreign minister, DJ Burkhalter, and we're grateful to Switzerland always for their service and their help. Among those remaining at the embassy were three Marine guards, Larry Morris, Mike East, and Jim Tracy. As they stepped outside, they were confronted by a large crowd standing between them and the flagpole. Tensions were high. No one felt safe. But the Marines had a mission to accomplish. And slowly, the crowd just parted in front of them as they made their way to the flagpole, lowered Old Glory, folded it, and returned to the building. Larry, Mike, and Jim had done their jobs, but they also made a bold promise that one day they would return to Havana and raise the flag again. At the time, no one could have imagined how distant that day would be. For more than half a century, U.S.-Cuban relations have been suspended in the amber of Cold War politics. In the interim, a whole generation of Americans and Cubans have grown up and grown old. The United States has had 10 new presidents. In a united Germany, the Berlin Wall is a fading memory. Freed from Soviet shackles, Central Europe is again home to thriving democracies. And last week, I was in Hanoi to mark the 20th anniversary of normalization of relations between the United States and Vietnam. Think about that. A long and terrible war that inflicted indelible scars on body and mind, followed by two decades of mutual healing, followed by another two decades of diplomatic and commercial engagement. In this period, Vietnam evolved from a country torn apart by violence into a dynamic society with one of the world's fastest growing economies. And all that time, through reconciliation, through normalization, Cuban-American relations remained locked in the past. Meanwhile, new technologies enabled people everywhere to benefit from shared projects across vast stretches of ocean and land. My friends, it doesn't take a GPS to realize that the road of mutual isolation and estrangement that the United States and Cuba were traveling was not the right one, and that the time has come for us to move in a more promising direction. In the United States, that means recognizing that U.S. policy is not the anvil on which Cuba's future will be forged. Decades of good intentions aside, the policies of the past have not led to a democratic transition in Cuba. It would be equally unrealistic to expect normalizing relations to have, in a short term, a transformational impact. After all, Cuba's future is for Cubans to shape. Responsibility for the nature and quality of governance and accountability rests, as it should, not with any outside entity, but solely within the citizens of this country. But the leaders in Havana and the Cuban people should also know that the United States will always remain a champion of democratic principles and reforms. Like many other governments in and outside this hemisphere, we will continue to urge the Cuban government to fulfill its obligations under the UN and Inter-American Human Rights Covenants, obligations shared by the United States and every other country in the Americas. And indeed, we remain convinced the people of Cuba would be best served by a genuine democracy, where people are free to choose their leaders, express their ideas, practice their faith, where the commitment to economic and social justice is realized more fully, where institutions are answerable to those they serve, and where civil society is independent and allowed to flourish. Let me be clear. The establishment of normal diplomatic relations is not something that one government does as a favor to another. It is something that two countries do together when the citizens of both will benefit. And in this case, the reopening of our embassies is important on two levels, people to people and government to government. First, we believe it's helpful for the people of our nations to learn more about each other, to meet each other. That is why we are encouraged that travel from the United States to Cuba has already increased by 35% since January and is continuing to go up. We are encouraged that more and more U.S. companies are exploring commercial ventures here that would create opportunities for Cuba's own rising number of entrepreneurs. And we are encouraged that U.S. firms are interested in helping Cuba expand its telecommunications and internet links, and that the government here recently pledged to create dozens of new and more affordable Wi-Fi hotspots. We also want to acknowledge the special role that the Cuban-American community is playing in establishing a new relationship between our countries. And in fact, we have with us this morning representatives from that community, some of whom were born here, and others who were born in the United States. And with their strong ties of culture and family, they can contribute much to the spirit of bilateral cooperation and progress that we are seeking to create, just as they have contributed much to their communities in their adopted land. The restoration of diplomatic ties will also make it easier for our governments to engage. After all, we are neighbors, and neighbors will always have much to discuss in such areas as civil aviation, migration policy, disaster preparedness, protecting marine environment, global climate change, and other tougher and more complex issues. Having normal relations makes it easier for us to talk, and talk can deepen understanding even when we know full well we will not see eye to eye on everything. We are all aware that notwithstanding President Obama's new policy, the overall U.S. embargo on trade with Cuba remains in place and can only be lifted by congressional action, a step that we strongly favor. For now, the President has taken steps to ease restrictions on remittances, on exports and imports to help Cuban private entrepreneurs, on telecommunications, on family travel, but we want to go further. The goal of all of these changes is to help Cubans connect to the world and to improve their lives. And just as we are doing our part, we urge the Cuban government to make it less difficult for their citizens to start businesses, to engage in trade, access information online. The embargo has always been something of a two-way street. Both sides need to remove restrictions that have been holding Cubans back. And before closing, I want to sincerely thank leaders throughout the Americas who have long urged the United States and Cuba to restore normal ties. I thank the Holy Father, Pope Francis, and the Vatican for supporting the start of a new chapter in relations between our countries. And I think it is not accidental that the Holy Father will come here and then to Washington, the United States, at this moment. I applaud President Obama and President Castro, both, for having the courage to bring us together in the face of considerable opposition. I am grateful to Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson and her team, to our counterparts in the Cuban Foreign Ministry, to our Chief of Mission, Ambassador Jeff De Laurentiis, and his extraordinary staff, for all of the hard work that has led up to this day. And I just say to our wonderful embassy staff, if you think you've been busy these past months, hold on to your seatbelts. But above all, I want to pay tribute to the people of Cuba and to the Cuban-American community in the United States. Jose Marti once said that everything that divides men is a sin against humanity. Clearly, the events of the past, the harsh words, the provocative and retaliatory actions the human tragedies, all have been a source of deep division that has diminished our common humanity. There have been too many days of sacrifice and sorrow, too many decades of suspicion and fear. That is why I am heartened by the many on both sides of the Straits who, whether because of family ties or a simple desire to replace anger with something more productive, have endorsed this search for a better path. We have begun to move down that path without any illusions about how difficult it may be, but we are each confident in our intentions, confident in the contacts that we have made, and pleased with the friendships that we have begun to forge. And we are certain that the time is now to reach out to one another as two peoples who are no longer enemies or rivals, but neighbors. Time to unfurl our flags, raise them up, and let the world know that we wish each other well. Estamos seguros de que este es el momento de acercarnos dos pueblos ya no enemigos ni rivales, sino vecinos. Es el momento de desplegar nuestras banderas, enarbolarlas, así hacerlas saber al resto del mundo que nos deseamos lo mejor los unos a los otros. It is with that healing mission in mind that I turn now to Larry Morris, Jim Tracy, and Mike East. 54 years ago, you gentlemen promised to return to Havana and hoist the flag over the United States Embassy that you lowered on that January day long ago. Today, I invite you on behalf of President Obama and the American people to fulfill that pledge by presenting the Stars and Stripes to be raised by members of our current military detachment. Larry, Jim, and Mike, this is your cue to deliver on words that would make any diplomat proud, just as they would any member of the United States Marine Corps. Promise made, promise kept. Thank you.
So what you just listened to, as we said, was Secretary of State John Kerry speaking today, Friday, on the formal reopening and raising the flag at the new American Embassy in Cuba. While some have seen this as a historic day, others have not. Marco Rubio, who is a presidential candidate and senator from Florida, Republican senator from Florida, criticized the Obama administration on their policy with Cuba. Marco Rubio his family is from Cuba and has been very critical of President Obama's outreach to the Cuban regime and Cuba in lifting and normalizing relations, which Rubio has called a reward to Castro and his human rights abuses. Moving on now, we look at WikiLeaks and the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, because WikiLeaks, the online website that is most known for having or hosting different military and diplomatic leaks, if you look at Bradley Manning, who's now known as Chelsea Manning since transitioning to be female. But at the time, it was Bradley Manning, now known as Chelsea Manning. Her leaks were put on WikiLeaks. And it's founded by Julian Assange, who is currently in an embassy he's currently in an embassy for safety purposes, or for his safety, as other countries have wished to extradite him, but he has asylum in that embassy. Moving on to actual story, WikiLeaks has offered $110,000, American dollars, for anyone who can bring them documents from relating to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. They announced this on Tuesday. Now, the website did launch a crowdfunding program in order to try to provide the reward money. At the time of our kind of writing, they had 20% of their goal. Now, there are some noteworthy people who have contributed to this. There is Greece's former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, and Vivian Westwood, who is a fashion designer and environmental campaigner, journalist Glenn Greenwald, and WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange. Now, WikiLeaks sent a statement, quote, TTIP, which is currently under negotiation between the U.S. and the European Union, remains closely guarded by negotiators and big corporations who have been... This seems to have some awkward wording, so I'm just going to reread or go back. Remains closely guarded by negotiators and big corporations have been given privileged access. The public cannot read it. Today, WikiLeaks is taking steps to ensure that Europeans can finally read the monster trade dead, end quote. Now, WikiLeaks alleges that the United States is using its free trade policy and economic might to hold back developing countries like Russia, China, and South Africa while reshaping the global economy as it sees fit. Quote, the secrecy of the TTIP casts a shadow on the future of a European democracy. Under this cover, special interests are running wild, much as we saw with the recent financial siege against the people of Greece. The TTIP affects the life of every European and draws Europe into long-term conflict with Asia. The time for secrecy to end is now, end quote. And that's coming from WikiLeaks founder and editor-in-chief, Julian Assange. Now, the European Commission, who is in charge of trade, has that they made efforts to be more transparent. Trade talks like these are typically hidden between the negotiating governments. That lends itself to criticism, as everyday people cannot read the agreements. Critics allege that corporations get to read, and sometimes corporations get to write the rules, but officially, they're hidden between the governments who are negotiating. Now, like we said, anti-free trade activists allege that free trade agreements serve to help the top corporations while hurting lower-income people. They point to evidence with free trade and where it's existed, where corporations bring in billions of dollars because they go to the countries. Because whenever you have a... Because the United States is one of the largest markets, and typically the United States is involved with this free trade. But what happens is the corporations in the United States take the jobs to wherever they can have them done cheapest, and then import them into the United States, and because it's free trade, there's no tariffs or anything like that they have to worry about. So it significantly reduces the process, which is good for them because they make more money, and it's good for the shareholders because there's more of a profit, so that helps their stock. But when they take it to those other countries, they're now spend, rather than paying wages that in the United States would be set by union or laws, they can pay American pennies or less than a dollar, significantly less. They do that because it's much cheaper. And so what happens is those corporations make millions and billions of dollars in profit from the savings, whereas the people don't get much there. Because of the countries that they're involved in, they don't have laws guaranteeing them actual like set hours or a wage more than a dollar, or even being allowed to leave. The videos you see oftentimes online are people who have to sleep in their factory because they're not allowed to leave. Those are often the result of free trade. Now, the European Union has taken steps to be open with the negotiations, or at least they've tried to be more open, and they claim they're trying to be open. The European Union had launched a website dedicated to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and post fact sheets and its proposals on there. And we note that they put their proposals, because they're not putting other people's proposals, they're not putting the finalized version, they're only putting their proposals. Now, the website made a similar move with the website being WikiLeaks, made a similar move with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. WikiLeaks leaked information from those talks. And moving on now, we go to the protests in Ferguson, which erupted this past week, with the one-year anniversary of when Michael Brown was shot by a police officer. Now, the Huffington Post's Wesley Lowery and the Washington... So the Huffington Post's Wesley Lowery and the Washington Post's Ryan Riley were both charged with trespassing and interfering with a police officer. They were charged in relation to when they were arrested last year while at a McDonald's. They were at the McDonald's at the end of the day after covering the protest. The statute of limitations expired this past Thursday for last year's arrest, so they were arrested with only days left in the statute of limitations. The outrage poured in from the Huffington Post and the Washington Post. This upcoming quote is from Marty Baron, who's the executive editor of the Washington Post, and he commented by saying, quote, "Charging a reporter with trespassing and interfering with a police officer when he was just doing his job is outrageous. You'd have thought law enforcement authorities would have come to their senses about this accident. Wells Lauer should never have been arrested in the first place. That was an abuse of police authority," end quote. Ryan Grimm, the Huffington Post Washington bureau chief, and Sam Stein, senior politics editor, released the following statement. Quote, "The Huffington Post condemns the charges filed by St. Louis County against our justice reporter Ryan J. Riley while covering the protests in Ferguson last year. Ryan has the full support of the Huffington Post in fighting these charges. Almost a year ago today, Ryan was working on his laptop at McDonald's near the protests in Ferguson, Missouri. A crime was committed at the McDonald's, not by journalists, but by local police who assaulted both Ryan and Wesley Lauer of the Washington Post during violent arrests. At least we know St. Louis County knows how to file charges. If Wesley Lowery and Ryan J. Riley can be charged like this with the whole country watching, just imagine what happens when nobody is." End quote. Lowery told the Washington Post that he, quote, "was surprised that a year later, this is something officials in St. Louis County decided was worth revisiting," end quote. However, on Twitter, Lowery joked that he had made a bet with Riley over whether or not charges would be filed. Riley apparently had bet that they would because he later tweeted Lowery that he owed him a McDonald's Happy Meal. When Lowery and Riley were arrested last year, they were sitting in a McDonald's, as the Huffington Post statement said. Police came in and told them to leave. The two were in the process of leaving, while Lowery was being given different information while trying to pack his items. Confusion ensued, and as the two were trying to figure it out, they were eventually arrested. Later on, they were taken to the police station, and they were eventually released along with everyone else in the media that had been arrested. However, that was ended up just being a release, not a closure on the incident, because as we see, they're now being charged. So we're going to move on now with the Trump campaign. Now, earlier this week, there was a little bit of confusion, because the Trump campaign had initially announced that Mr. Trump had fired his top political advisor, Roger Stone, over email. Alerts were put out, breaking news. However, it turned out to not be true, because hours afterwards, the truth finally did emerge. Instead, Stone had actually resigned from the campaign and was going quietly until the campaign announced that he'd been fired. Stone provided a resignation letter to the Washington Post and has gone on Twitter and CNN to say that he quit the Trump campaign. An email from him to Trump has also been obtained by Politico. And he wrote, quote, "I was proud to have played a role in the launch of your presidential campaign. Your message of Make America Great Again harkened back to the Reagan era. Restoring national pride and bringing jobs back to America, your initial and still underlying message, is a solid conservative message. In fact, it catapulted you instantly into a commanding lead in the race. Unfortunately, the current controversies involving personalities and provocative media fights have reached such a high volume that it has distracted attention from your platform and overwhelmed your core message. With this current direction of the candidacy, I no longer can remain involved in your campaign." The former Nixon and Reagan advisor said that he disagreed with Trump's feud with Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly, who has actually just gone on vacation that was previously scheduled. Nonetheless, Trump attacked Kelly last Friday on CNN's Don Lemon, when he said that she was bleeding from her eyes and her, quote, "wherever," end quote. While many have taken that comment to imply, or as implication on Trump's part, the Fox News anchor was on her period, Trump has since said he was referring to her nose. Stone has also complained about Trump ever since he became a frontrunner, or as a frontrunner, and how he's changed since being a frontrunner. According to Politico, Stone told friends, quote, "he is losing his grip on reality," end quote, Stone had told them, who then told Politico. Then he also said, quote, "he has these yes men around him, and now he's living in a parallel world." Stone was in some controversy himself a week ago when he attacked two figures in the media. He attacked CNN's Anna Navarro and former CNN commentator and now TV News 1 anchor Roland Martin, and then called him, quote, "quota hires," end quote. We move on now to the state of the race. Now, the state of the race, as we said, at least on the Democratic side, remains in a little bit of flux, as we wait to see whether or not Vice President Biden will get in. Polls have started to include him yet again after a brief period when he wasn't really being included. So when we look at the Republican nomination, there haven't been as many polls that have come out since the debate. There were a lot of debates or polls out beforehand, especially since those ones were important in determining who would be in the debate, and that gave them a lot more attention. But since then, we haven't had them coming out at the same pace. Of the polls that we still do have, Trump continues to be in the lead. He remains in the lead by, depending on the poll, a pretty significant amount, although the polls differ on how significant. Some have him still in the 20s, other ones have him more down in the 17s. What is clear from him, though, is that the debate has shaken up the race. Carly Fiorina, who an NBC News poll found as the winner of the debates, even though she was not even in the prime time debate, she was instead in the 5 p.m. debate, because beforehand she was hovering right around 0%, has now spiked in the polls both nationally and in state-by-state races, especially in New Hampshire, where she has focused most of her time on the campaign. She is now starting to get into like the 8% and the 9%. And another person who got a big bump was Ben Carson. So what we see looking large scale is that these kind of outsiders who don't have a political history or political career benefited from this debate and kind of speak to what we're seeing similar or with Donald Trump of a rejection kind of the typical politician and establishment politicians on the Republican side. Carson, Trump, and Fiorina, got the biggest positive impact from the debate. Carson has now starting to move back into the top tier when it comes to the race. But those who have kind of gotten hurt are former Governor Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. Scott Walker and Jeb Bush, they were kind of seen as doing all right in the debates. They weren't widely praised, but they weren't criticized as having a bad debate. Although some criticized both Walker and Bush for being a little stale and unenthusiastic during the debate. So those two have taken a bit of the hit. They used to be, a while back, kind of first and second. But then after Trump, for second and third. And now they're starting to move into lower single digits. And even with Bush's case, some polls have him in seventh place. That is coming from a guy who, just as recent as a few weeks ago, even a month ago, was in first place nationally. When it comes to the other side, the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton remains with a large lead in the Democratic national polling, Bernie Sanders in second, and Vice President Biden close behind in third. Everyone else being Martin O'Malley of Maryland, former governor, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, who is a senator and a governor, and Jim Webb, who is a senator from Virginia, all hover right around 1% and 0%. Lincoln Chafee hovering or at 0%. When it comes to the Iowa poll, because this week, or as we're talking about this, the Iowa State Fair has been going on. Iowa State Fair, always very important every 4 years as candidates come, and it's basically a requirement in the state where you go and you talk on the soapbox that is sponsored by the Des Moines Register. And then you also tend to have some deep-fried food that's kind of a trademark. But that's been going on, so we'll take a look at the Iowa caucus. There, Clinton remains having a really strong lead. Sanders in second, and then, although he does keep getting closer, the latest poll from CNN has him only 19 points behind. And then there's Vice President Biden second, or third, with 12. And then after that, right at the bottom, with 1%, O'Malley and Webb, and finally at 0, Chafee. Of course, with the caucus, we never really know what could happen because it's harder to poll with a caucus just because of the way it is. The way a caucus works is you go and you get there and everyone kind of talks about their candidates, and then you go and you group up and they talk more and then they regroup, and eventually you have a final grouping, and that's when you kind of vote and you determine the winners from that precinct, and that happens all across the state. But you do walk in for a little bit at least, open to persuasion. Certainly in relation or compared to other, well, primaries. Because a primary, for the most part, you walk in knowing who you're going to vote for. You may not always, but you tend to not be that persuaded by the people outside who are just giving the little cards. In a caucus, it's perfectly fine, and sometimes even better if you do show up. Well, maybe not better, but it's perfectly fine if you show up not knowing who to vote for, because there's caucus leaders and precinct leaders there who's the only reason they're there is to persuade you to come over and vote for them. So with that, it's possible that a lot of people could go in voting for Clinton, and of course when it comes to name recognition, that would help her in a poll. They know who she is, but when they walk in, hear about other candidates such as Bernie Sanders, Biden, if he runs, O'Malley, Webb, and Chaffee, could end up switching. Of course, that could happen for any candidate. Someone could walk in for Lincoln Chaffee and then switch over to any other candidates. But caucuses are hard to pull because people walk in there with a strong possibility of changing their eventual vote, which of course makes them hard to pull. On the Republican side, where all the same applies, where you could walk in and very well change your vote or who you support, Donald Trump does remain in the lead. Scott Walker, who was leading in the state, has now moved into third, with Dr. Ben Carson now taking second. Carly Fiorina is starting to do much better in the state. She's starting to get into fourth, heavy fourth. Then you have Ted Cruz, Mark Rubio, and then finally you have Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush, polling wise, has never really done well in Iowa, but he's always had a respectable kind of amount. An amount that wouldn't cause any fear for his campaign. However, now he's not doing so well in New Hampshire, and he's not doing well in Iowa, which means he would have to kind of wait till South Carolina to possibly notch a win if these current polls are indicating. And of course, then we would eventually get to Florida, although because in South Carolina, polls do have Donald Trump leading. The one interesting thing that we're noticing, and we'll have to keep looking at data-wise throughout the general election, is thanks to the Fox News debate, this election has largely been a national primary, whereas before candidates would mostly focus on Iowa and New Hampshire, and if you didn't hear about them in Pennsylvania or California, that was right because you didn't have to. Now candidates or people all across the nation know about these candidates because of the national polling. That has kind of changed the race because now there's less of a focus. There's still a heavy focus on Iowa and New Hampshire, but there's less of a focus as there has been in previous cycles, and more of a focus on national name recognition and national polling. And so what will be interesting to see with that is how much national polls reflect state polls, because typically there'd be some kind of deviance. In 2012, John Huntsman did fairly well when it came to the New Hampshire primary. He was still hovering right at the bottom for national polling, though. This time around, national polling seems to be reflected in a lot of the state polling. Donald Trump is leading nationally. He's leading in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina. People who are doing poor in nationally are tending to do poor in those individual states. Of course, we'll have to keep looking at more data as it comes out, because we've got over 400 days until the election day, so we'll have a boatload of data just with the nominations on both sides, although it reflects more on the Republican side with the way they had their debates set up. That's a certain, we may have a correlation there that we'll have to take more of a look at and be sure to watch over these upcoming weeks. And of course, that political data, at least for junkies like me and presumably a good portion of our viewers, are fascinating, and we'll be sure to keep an eye on that. And of course, we'll be able to keep an eye on that in our upcoming weeks, because this week is just about, well, done. Thank you for joining us on, that was a little bit of an awkward transition, but thank you for joining us on the JungleCast this week. Be sure to join us every week for the latest news and when we have them interviews, and of course, that data that we just brought up. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at TKNNPOLJungle. Tweet us your comments, your suggestions, questions if you have any. We'll be sure to answer any of them, and if they're appropriate and it's fitting to bring them up in the podcast. We just always love hearing that information, and the feedback only can make us better. So until then, till next week, for TKNN, I'm Tyler, wishing you good news and a good night.